Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books, an independent New Orleans bookstore. Additional support comes from the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. Hello and welcome to The Reading Life, WWNO's weekly look at the New Orleans literary scene. I'm Susan Larson. This week I'll be talking with Tyler Bridges, co-author with Jeremy Alford of Longshot, A Soldier, A Senator, A Serious Sin, An Epic Louisiana Election. We'll also hear from Will Schwalbe, whose beautiful new book about reading is Books for Living. It is a great pleasure to welcome Tyler Bridges to The Reading Life. Tyler is the co-author with Jeremy Alford of Longshot, A Soldier, A Senator, A Serious Sin, An Epic Louisiana Election. Tyler is well known for covering Louisiana politics, and you probably know him from his writing for Baton Rouge and New Orleans Advocate, as well as two previous books, Bad Bet on the Bayou, The Rise of Gambling in Louisiana, and The Fall of Governor Edwin Edwards, as well as The Rise of David Duke. So Tyler Bridges, welcome to The Reading Life.
So glad to be here, Susan.
Oh, so here we have the story in Longshot of the race between John Bel Edwards and David Vedder. So tell us why the average citizen is going to read this book. They're going to think, I know this story. I read the papers. I know how this turns out. What is it you want the readers to take away from this book?
What Jeremy Alford and I tried to do with Longshot is to tell a story where you know the outcome. And it's sort of reminiscent for me of the old Columbo TV show. Remember the detective?
Yes.
You saw who committed the murder at the beginning, and the fun was to see how he solved it. So you knew the outcome. And what Jeremy and I tried to do with this story is tell it in such a way that so even though you know who's going to win the race, you're going to want to turn the page to find out what happens next. And what we did was, once the race was over, we interviewed over 100 people. I interviewed John Bel Edwards 7 different times as the governor. I interviewed the First Lady, Donna Edwards, one night for 2.5 hours. And the goal, again, was to provide the information that the campaigns could not tell me or Jeremy while we were covering the race. And again, with the idea that you want to turn the page because there'll be new details. You want to see what happened because we're really trying to put the reader in the room as the important events are taking place.
Now, one of the things that fascinates me as an average reader with an average interest in politics is that you show that the race itself is really the tip of the iceberg. You show there's this underlying structure of party officials, fundraisers, pollsters, consultants. I mean, it's a huge kind of infrastructure that you're lifting up for us to look at, isn't it?
Right. So the people who followed last year's governor's race will be familiar with the candidates. And as you said, in Longshot, we go way below that and talk to all of the top people in the various campaigns and tell their stories and their roles. And also, we try to give the reader a sense of the uniqueness of Louisiana politics with a chapter on the Louisiana Political Hall of Fame. Yes, Louisiana has a Political Hall of Fame up in Winfield. Also, we have another chapter on the D.C. Mardi Gras, where a lot of people from Louisiana go up to Washington for the Mardi Gras. And that's something that's very unique.
And that, I think, deserves its own book, Tyler. I'm just saying. It would be
all right,
something
all right.
Fun to read. So. Now, you write extensively about the strategies these two men employed to come out facing each other in the runoff. And a lot of it has to do with access to the press, with crafting a message and carrying through with it.
Right. Yeah, we want to give readers a sense of the interplay, the behind-the-scenes stuff that goes into politics. So when you see a TV commercial or you see a candidate hold a press conference, what is all involved in what you end up seeing. And again, with all the interviews we did, just meticulously digging and digging and digging to find out what the real story. And what we tried to do is to set up this as a race where one guy, David Vedder, the senior senator from Louisiana, is the heavy favorite. And he is seeking political redemption from the serious sin with the prostitute. And he's seeking political redemption by winning the Super Bowl of Louisiana politics, the governor's mansion. And if he can win this race, he'll probably be the most powerful governor in Louisiana since Huey Long. On the other hand, we have John Bel Edwards, the Democrat, running in a red state, a guy who has been a member of the state House of Representatives and is just tired of losing to Bobby Jindal. So he says, I need to go big. I'm going to run for governor. And nobody gives him a chance, or very few people do. That's why we call the book Long Shot. And there's two other major candidates in the race, the fiery Cajun, Scott Angell from Breaux Bridge. And then the fourth candidate, another Republican, is Jay Darden, the lieutenant governor and the good government candidate. And we tell some really neat stories. In fact, we have a story, and this was gotten by my co-author, Jeremy. It's a great Edwin Edwards story that's never been told before involving Jay Darden. And inevitably, there's an LSU co-ed in the story, too.
Never fails. I love the way you describe our jungle primary, which is such an odd, odd political thing, you know, and the way John Bel Edwards managed to emerge as the one who faced David Vitter.
Yeah, well, we try to take the reader through the various twists and turns, and there was lots of them, as you know. And one of the things that we write about that he faced was trying to keep out another big name Democrat, specifically the mayor of New Orleans, Mitch Landrieu. If Mitch Landrieu had gotten in that race, John Bel Edwards would never have been elected governor. So we talk about the various strategies that John Bel Edwards employed to try to keep Landrieu out of the race, and he ultimately did succeed. So he was the only Democrat who ran.
And then there was the shadow of another Governor Edwards. I loved what Edwin Edwards told John Bel to say when people ask if they were related.
If we're related, great. No, what did he say?
If they like me, great.
If they don't, then we're not related.
Right. No, I thought that
and
was
And in fact,
real.
They're not related.
Now, the other thing that I thought was so fascinating in this particular political story is that you really give the women their due. And there are some really striking and strong women who are involved in this race. Donna Edwards, Wendy Vitter, Kathleen Blanco, and various other women of David Vitter's acquaintance. So what was it like putting them into the proper perspective, the candidates' wives particularly?
Well, one of the things, Susan, we tried to do with Long Shot is to present another side of David Vitter that the public hasn't seen. And in fact, I was talking to a trial lawyer the other day, a supporter of John Bel Edwards, who has quickly read the book and said, you know, I'm not a fan of David Vitter's, but the book got me thinking in a different light. And part of that is Wendy Vitter, who chose to stand by her man. But we try to present that she did not do that in a way of weakness that some people might associate, but as actually a very strong, independent woman. And Donna Edwards, my gosh, the things that she went through with the raising of her daughter, Samantha, and your listeners will remember undoubtedly one of the striking TV ads from the race was Donna Edwards sitting next to her husband and talking about the decision they made to give birth to their first daughter, Samantha, knowing that she had spina bifida and the doctor telling her she probably would never ever be able to walk. And when I sat down with Donna, she told me the full story and the difficult decision. She was on her own because her husband was in the Army. He was gone a lot. They had to meet in a parking lot where she told him so much of this. And they made this decision to go forward with to give birth to Samantha. And then the difficulty that Donna faced in raising her daughter and giving her all sorts of time and love. So today, Samantha is a functioning daughter who's, I think she's about to graduate from university.
That's an incredible story. I think everybody does remember that ad. And everyone does get, that's one of the things you do so well in this book, is give a kind of full picture of them as family men, that there are consequences for these families in being in politics. And I think you do get a lot of compassion for those people who get thrust into the limelight, you know, somewhat willingly, but not always the limelight they were seeking. So how did you and Jeremy work on this book? Describe that process of collaboration.
So the original idea for the book was mine, and I went to him. I just didn't think I would have time to get the book out in time. I outlined the book chapter by chapter. Somebody many years ago showed me how to do that for a book. Won't say who that was. And so we divided up responsibilities. So we each had to write, let's say, the initial chapter, and then we would send it to the other person as a Word document and edit it in the edited form in Word, send it back, and then that whosever original chapter was would incorporate most of those changes. And then it would be sent to Clancy Dubos, our editor, and he would make more changes. And in the end, while I had primary responsible for certain chapters and Jeremy did too, we all have our fingerprints over everything. And we ended up working in a Google Doc at the end, the wow. three of us, because with Google Docs, you can all be in the same document simultaneously. So at the end, we all read the same Google Doc. We all marked it up and we all could see those changes. And we spent, I think it was about a week, every night till midnight. The last night we went to 3:30 in the morning on a Friday night, just going line by line. If somebody had a query or a question or a comment, we would address that and then move on to the next one. And it was a very sort of meticulous process, but hopefully we got a good result from that.
What do you think you and Jeremy learned from each other doing this book together? Do you think you upped each other's games a bit?
Absolutely. I think, Susan, I could have written this book by myself, having written two books before, but it's a better book with the collaboration of Jeremy, because he particularly added stuff that I didn't have. And then he brought in Clancy. I've known Clancy, but he's known him better. So Clancy added a whole great element. But you know, our styles are a bit different. My style is really to interview lots of folks and kind of tell the unfolding story. Jeremy contributed particularly the chapters on the Washington Mardi Gras and the Louisiana Political Hall of Fame, which really capture sort of in a broad, panoramic way the unique aspect of Louisiana politics.
Oh, they're very atmospheric. They really set a tone.
Yeah, he did a great job.
So how do you think we're doing? I mean, the last chapter in this book is depressing, Tyler. You know, it's sort of the more things change, the more they stay the same.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. I think readers will come away with a clear sense after reading this book that the guy they elected last year for governor is the guy they have today. There's no surprise. For example, you know, as I read about Donald Trump, who's going to be the president, you can see he said one thing during the campaign, or he said different things, and now in certain cases he seems to be saying something different, will govern differently. I think readers will come away with not only with a deep appreciation of who John Bel Edwards is in a way they haven't before, but I think they should come away with a clear sense that he is the governor that he promised to be.
Well, it's just a fascinating read. I enjoyed every page. I did. And
That's great.
I think people who think they know what happened will be surprised and educated. We've been talking with Tyler Bridges, who is the co-author with Jeremy Alford of Long Shot, A Soldier, A Senator, A Serious Sin, An Epic Louisiana Election. For more information or to buy the book, you can check out LouisianaLongShot.com as well as area bookstores. Tyler, thanks so much.
Always a pleasure, Susan.
The dew is hanging diamonds on the clover. The moon is listening to the nightingale. And while we're off and dream, the world around us seems like a Louisiana fairy tale.
Will Schwalbe is one of my favorite book people. He's worked in publishing, digital media, and is founder and CEO of the website Cookster.com. He wrote his first New York Times bestseller, The End of Your Life Book Club, about the books he read with his mother as she battled pancreatic cancer. And now he's back with another meditation on and celebration of what reading can do. It's called Books for Living. Will Schwalbe, welcome back to The Reading Life.
Oh, thank you, Susan. Thank you so much for having me back.
Now, I love your description of why you included so many books you read when you were young in this book. You say, I'm not just a 50-something-year-old reader. I'm the reader I was at every age I've ever been, with all the books I've ever read and all the experiences I've ever had, constantly shifting and recombining in my brain. And that is so true.
Yes, books, they stay with you in remarkable ways. And those first books we read, one of my favorites as a kid was Stuart Little, is a book that is part of who I am. I mean, I think Stuart Little made me the man I am today.
Well, it's quite a man.
He was quite a mouse.
Yes, he was. But it's so interesting that when you are a reader and you look back over your life, you see that progression over time.
You see that progression. And it also, I love the way that your relationship to books changes. So Stuart meant something very different to me at age 5 than he meant to me at age 25 or than he means to me today. But all of that combines. My experience of Stuart Little is an ever-changing, ever-evolving one. And that's one of the incredible things about the books of our lives, is they grow with us.
And these are all books that you say have helped you in some way, have moved you along on your life's path. So tell us about those books. One of the ones you refer to again and again is The Importance of Living by Lin Yutang. So tell us how you got to know that book and how you turned to it today.
It's such a remarkable book. So I was a little bit obsessed, and still am, with the 1930s and the writers of the 1930s, writers like Christopher Isherwood and W.H. Auden. And actually, I came to it because I fell in love with the movie Cabaret, and that led me to the writers of the 30s because Cabaret is based on Christopher Isherwood's extraordinary Berlin stories that he wrote in the 30s in Berlin. And so the more I read about the 1930s, the more I encountered this name that was unfamiliar to me, Lin Yutang, and a book called The Importance of Living, which was one of the biggest bestsellers of the 30s. It was sort of Tuesdays with Morrie for the 1930s. And so I searched this book out in a library, and I discovered a book of really life-changing wisdom. And there was Lin Yutang in the 30s writing about what he called the noble art of leaving things undone. And it's a book about enjoying your friends. It's a book about relaxing and taking naps and appreciating poetry and literature and drinking tea. And it all seems very charming and maybe even a little bit twee. And then you realize what he's doing, because he's writing it in the 1930s. And he's writing it seeing the rise of Stalin and Hitler. And he's warning the world against a culture of greed and ambition and worship of power. And he's positing that reading, in particular, is the mark of the reasonable person, and it is really the hallmark of everything good. So I found this book decades ago and helped bring it back into print when I was in publishing. But for me, it's really a touchstone. It's a book about the reading life and how it's not something trivial. In fact, the fate of the world rests on it.
And I love that you got to bring it back into print. That's one of the great moments in someone's life if they're in the book world, you know?
Oh, it was incredible. And in doing so, I got to be in contact with Lin Yutang's daughters, only one of whom is still alive, and I'm still in contact with her. We had the most extraordinary conversations, and I was able to use her stories about Lin Yutang in this book.
So after I read your book, I downloaded it, and it seems to me it's the perfect book to read at this time of year because, you know, it's the time when we're looking back, setting a course for the new year, determining what we want to do going forward.
Oh, absolutely. And it's so bizarrely topical, too. There's a section that I absolutely love. And remember, this was written in 1937 and published in 1938. And he's talking about the most famous tea house in China. And he despairs because he sees tourists at this tea house. And they're so busy taking pictures of themselves drinking tea that they forget to enjoy the tea.
Right.
And that was in the 30s. And any restaurant in New Orleans or New York, you see people so busy taking pictures of their food that they're forgetting even to taste their food.
Exactly. Now, there are two things you associate with reading that I do as well, and they are hope and prayer. And I wish you'd talk a little bit about that, because we both associate books with hope, you know?
When I begin a book, it's with curiosity. That's one of the things that leads me. But it's also with hope. That sort of exciting moment when you turn the first page and are you going to meet a friend? Is there going to be a wonderful passage? Is there wisdom that might affect your life? Is there a realization? Will you see your life differently afterwards? And it's a very hopeful feeling. Readers are hopeful people. And one of the points I really wanted to make in this book is I feel the same kind of hope no matter what kind of book I'm reading. And in fact, some of the life's wisdom that I've encountered in books that's been most meaningful to me have been from really disparate sources, maybe from a thriller, a Jack Reacher thriller, or maybe from a cookbook. So that hope is always there.
And you write a good bit about Annie Lamott, whom I also adore, and prayer.
Yes, because I'm someone who is constantly looking for prayers. I'm not the most religious person in the world, but prayer is really meaningful to me. Words that will resonate deep within me, that will lend themselves to being repeated, that will help me make meaning in my life and live my life more fully. And I find them everywhere, and I often find them in books. And Anne Lamott has in Traveling Mercies a wonderful thing where she says, the two best prayers are help me, help me, help me, and thank you, thank you, thank you. And then she wrote a terrific little book where she adds an additional prayer to that, which is wow.
I know, that's my favorite.
That's a very good one.
Oh, now another thing I really love about this book, if someone were we're going to use this book as a map for reading for a year, or book group selections for a year. You just couldn't go wrong because of the great infinite variety in this book, which is what I love. You found things to learn from Girl on the Train.
Yes. And I'm so glad you brought up the book thing. I made this book 26 chapters because I thought if someone did want to do that, they could basically read a book every 2 weeks. And when I travel around the country, one thing that always makes me a little bit sad is sometimes people apologize for the book they're reading. I say, what are you reading? And they'll tell me, because they don't think the book is maybe what others would regard as highbrow enough. But I absolutely loved a book like Girl on the Train, and I learned so much from it. And that's the book I talk about in terms of it teaches you who to trust.
Right.
That all really wonderful suspense and thriller novels make you test your prejudices and preconceptions, because you have to figure out who's telling the truth and who isn't. And what I love, love, love about Girl on the Train, don't worry, no spoilers, never do that. But what I love about it is our narrator, one of our three narrators, rather, isn't even entirely sure she can trust herself. And I think that's a great lesson to go through life, is it's often at the times when you think you are most right that you're entirely wrong.
Now, one of the chapters I took to heart very much was called Admiring Greatness. And it's about Toni Morrison's Song of Solomon, but it's also about a friend of yours who was a voracious reader, but who near the end of his life began to limit the number of books he kept.
So this was a wonderful friend. He'd been a university professor and a great traveler. He had served in the military in World War II, in Morocco and in Paris. And he had a vast collection of books, but when he got into his later years, he decided, somewhat arbitrarily, that he would have 100 books, and only 100 books. And if he read a book, at the end of it, he could either keep it and give away another book, or give away that book, but he could never have more than 100. And what was fascinating is it caused him to be very thoughtful about his library, and when he died, he died of a stroke, actually, while he was reading. When he died, he left a kind of autobiography on his bookshelf, that the story of his life was contained in the 100 books he left. And it really emphasized to me, we are what we read. And there were books about Morocco and Paris and travel writers. He loved martinis. There were books about martinis. He loved George Bernard Shaw. There was George Bernard Shaw, and there was Song of Solomon, one of the all-time great books.
Not so many novels, but that one.
Not so many novels, but that one, exactly.
So you have that problem that I do of having a house full of books.
Oh, yes.
So how do you deal with the overflow?
We have books everywhere. We have these enormous stacks on the floor. So at night, as I'm on the way to get a glass of water, to try to navigate the book piles is something terrible, especially because I'm not much of a structural engineer. So the big coffee table books sit on tops of stacks of paperbacks. So they're always going over. I have a big problem with books.
Yeah.
I haven't figured out. If you figure out a system, do let me know. I don't have the strength or resolve to get myself down to a 100-book library, though. I might try.
I never will. Although your book would be a very good place to start, I think, for a lot of us.
It is, and there are, certainly I have a special shelf of books, the books that don't go on the floor, and Song of Solomon is one of those. It has earned its permanent place on a very special shelf. And I do feel that as readers, to some degree, we curate our libraries when people ask us what to read. That great question, someone says, what should I read? And I do usually have a group of 10 or so books, which are the books that I recommend to just about everybody. I mean, a book like Crossing to Safety by Wallace Stegner, or Song of Solomon by Toni Morrison. And to some degree, that becomes a kind of curated library in my head.
Well, I have a little free library in my front yard, and it helps to get rid of the overflow.
Oh, that's great that you do that.
But you don't have that luxury in New York.
We don't have New York City. It's a little hard. I don't think I could get away with putting one up outside my building.
Well, I have to ask you, what are you reading right now?
Right this minute, I'm reading Upstream, the essays by poet Mary Oliver. And they are just so beautiful and so necessary. And it's her writing about Poe and Emerson and Whitman, but also about nature, as she always does, and about joy. It's a slender, slender volume, but it's just breathtaking.
Well, I bet you recommend it in your next book.
I think there's a very good shot that I will, exactly.
Oh, that's so great. Well, it has been such a pleasure. We've been talking with Will Schwalbe, whose wonderful new book is Books for Living. Use it as a roadmap for your reading in 2017, and you can't go wrong. Will, thank you so much.
Thank you, Susan.
Here's what's on tap in the literary life this week. Anne Levy, who was a hidden child in Poland during World War II, became the subject of Lawrence Powell's troubled memory, Anne Levy, the Holocaust, and David Duke's Louisiana. She'll be the special guest at the World War II Reading Group, Thursday, January 5th at 7 at the East Bank Regional Library in Metairie. The Poetry Buffet presents fiction readings by Moira Crone, Barb Johnson, and Jonathan Klein, Saturday, January 7th at 2 at Ladder Library. The Monday Night Writers Group meets Monday, January 9th at 7 at Barnes & Noble Metairie. The New Orleans-based live arts magazine Antenna, Signals issue number 4, is now accepting submissions of short works of fiction, nonfiction, poetry, and prose on the theme of terra formation, working the elements of a creative practice. Each written piece must be 1,500 words or fewer. They will accept up to 10 for inclusion in the next issue. Each accepted submission will also receive a small honorarium. For questions, email Imani, I-M-A-N-I, at antenna.works. The deadline is January 10th. The Women's National Book Association is holding its annual writing contest with 4 awards in the following categories: fiction, creative nonfiction, and poetry. The contest is open for submissions until January 15th. For more information, go to wnba-books.org. Submissions are open until January 15th, and the winners will be announced May 1st, 2017. Plan now to attend Writers Resist, the New Orleans event in a national series of readings, a multi-author reading event designed to inspire activism and community. Sunday, January 15th at 2 at the Art Garage, 2231 St. Claude Avenue. For more information, check out writersresist.org or the Writers Resist New Orleans Facebook page. Reading Big Fat Books for Fun begins its 6-week reading of the Canterbury Tales, Monday, January 16th at 6 in Abita Springs. For more information about this group, email Susan Blaylock at Abita Blaylock, that's B-L-A-L-O-C-K, at gmail.com. And here's something really exciting coming up at Tulane University. The Living Library takes place Thursday, January 26th from 11 a.m. to 3, and Saturday, January 28th from 1 to 4 at the Lavin Burnick Center for University Life. The Living Library was started in 2000 at the Roskilde Festival in Copenhagen, Denmark, and was organized by a youth organization called Stop the Violence. It's a personal way to promote mutual understanding and break down barriers, real or perceived, within a local community. Here's how it works. Individuals volunteer to be books, and attendees become readers who check out a book, meaning they sit with the volunteer to hear their story. If you'd like to volunteer to tell your story, check out LibGuides, that's LibGuides, tulane.edu/livinglibrary. If you're a student who's a fan of Jane Austen, consider entering the 2017 Jane Austen Society of North America's Essay Contest, which invites you to submit short essays that address imagining film or stage adaptations of Austen's work. Prizes are generous, and the deadline is May 21st, 2017. For more information, visit the Essay Contest page at jasna, J-A-S-N-A, .org. Major support for The Reading Life comes from Octavia Books. Additional support comes from the Christwood Retirement Community, Our Lady of Holy Cross College, and the University of Louisiana at Lafayette Press. The theme song and end music for The Reading Life is by Matt Perrine and Sunflower City. The Reading Life is produced by Jenny Lawson and is a production of WWNO. You can listen to us anytime or subscribe to our podcast at wwno.org. Or you can email us anytime at thereadinglife@wwno.org. I'm Susan Larson. Thanks for listening, and keep reading.